stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us today. If you're new to the program and you're not a Catholic, well, by golly, this is your program. We are here to answer questions primarily from non-Catholics, although Catholics also call in sometimes. Maybe they've got a question that a coworker asked of them and they don't know the answer, and so they call in. So that's perfectly fine. We'd love to take your call today at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question about the Catholic faith. 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also shoot us an email on that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, and Matt Kabinski screening the phone calls, and they're coming in right now, fast and furious. Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube, we're streaming there right now. We're also streaming live on Facebook. In both cases, you can put your question in the comments box. Rich will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio and love to get your question answered on today's program. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing okay. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Interesting question. This is one that came in actually yesterday on YouTube. We couldn't get to it because we just ran out of time. This one from Tony. Tony says, where does the new perspectives on Paul differ from Catholic theology?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, first of all, the new perspectives on Paul is an academic school of thought.
Okay.
it's not a theological tradition.
Okay.
Even less is it a religious tradition, and so to my way of looking at it, almost any academic school of thought can be reconciled to Catholic doctrine. You know, if you make a few tweaks and caveats,
yeah.
And the question is is it true to history? That's the question we should be asking as historians. And if the answer is yes, if these scholars have genuine insights into the meaning of a text based in its Second Temple Jewish context, which is what they're attempting to do, then the job of a Catholic theologian is to take what we now know about historical data and then accommodate that to Catholic theology or work that into Catholic theology. So let me explain what I mean by that. So the Catholic faith has always taught that faith and reason cannot contradict one another, because the same God that made the natural world made the supernatural world, and he's not going to contradict himself.
Right.
And so, in the natural sciences, it's easy to see how that shakes out. So, for example, when Galileo was floating the Copernican view of the universe, and that stirred a little bit of controversy, Bellarmine, the Vatican's chief theologian at the time, said, well, I think Galileo's wrong. I think Copernicus is wrong. Because at that time, they didn't have experimental confirmation of the theory. And he thought it was wrong because Aristotle was against it. So the best science of the day, up till that time, had not confirmed that theory. And he also thought it contradicted the Bible. But he says, but look, if Galileo can prove his theory empirically, well, then obviously I've misinterpreted the Bible. And that's what happened.
Wow.
That's what happened. So, within a generation or so, the Copernican theory was in fact proven, and the church said, oh, well, then I guess that's what Genesis means. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
Rather than like the fundamentalist view, which is just to say, well, that contradicts what I think the Bible says, so I'm just going to throw out the science. Catholic Church doesn't do that. We don't throw out the science. We say, okay, let's figure out how this science can be accommodated to Catholic faith. Well, we do the same thing with history. And when it comes to biblical studies, so, let's take a simple matter. say, the doctrine of Mark in priority, which is the view of most biblical scholars that the Gospel of Mark was written before Matthew and Luke. And there's really good reasons to hold that. Well, you know, there may be characters in tradition that thought that Matthew came first because it's first in canonical order.
Mm-hmm.
Then historians present really good arguments that Mark came first, and Catholic theologians go, oh, I guess Mark came first. Let's see how we can accommodate that. All right. So the new perspectives on Paul is an attempt to read Paul in light of Second Temple, first century Judaism.
Mm.
And in view of that fact, they've made some interesting insights into Paul's language. And, you know, where it really has the most theological significance would be on questions of justification, what these kinds of words of righteousness and justification mean in the context of St. Paul. And from my point of view, when I was coming along as a student of theology and not yet Catholic, encountering the new perspectives on Paul's school of scholarship, particularly guys like N.T. Wright and Christer Stendahl, was a huge bridge for me to become Catholic. Because although they were not explicating Paul's doctrine as Catholics and they weren't using it to defend Catholic faith, in fact, those guys are not Catholics and not particularly friendly to Catholics.
Yeah.
In Wright in particular, they put a heavy emphasis on Paul's doctrine having a strongly ecclesial note, meaning that for him, justification is a declaration that one has been made a member of the covenant people, that one's joined the community. And so, you know, it's not an individualistic way of conceiving of salvation. And they were basically refuting Luther's understanding of justification. So it kind of killed two birds with one stone for me. Mm. It detached me from the Lutheran understanding of justification, and it opened me up to a more ecclesial understanding of salvation. Now, that's not all the way to Catholic doctrine, but it was, for me, an important bridge. And typically, you find that, you know, Catholic types like me are fairly friendly to the New Perspectives guys, and the farther to the right you go within, say, fundamentalist Protestantism, the less they like it.
Mm.
Right? So it was for many, many people, it has been a bridge from conservative Protestantism to Catholicism.
Tony, great question. Thanks for checking in with us on YouTube. Again, that question came in yesterday, but we couldn't get to it. Hopefully, Tony is listening today and got your question answered. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Ann in Kansas City, also Russ in Nashville. We've got several lines open for you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Several lines open for you, 833-288-3986. As we've mentioned a number of times on this program and elsewhere, Mother Angelica, our foundress, was a big fan of being where the people are. So that's why whenever a new social platform would come out, a new media of some kind, like, you know, cable TV or emails or something like that, she would say, look, let's get on it. Let's find out what it's all about. And we can be there for the people. And one of those that has persisted to this day is the iHeart Radio app for your phone. You can listen to the lead EWTN radio live stream. If you've got that puppy on your phone, go to iHeart Radio and search EWTN. It is absolutely free. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to begin today with Ann in Kansas City, listening on the EWTN app. Ann, what's on your mind today?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really respect your prudential opinion. My sister-in-law is a baptized Catholic, and last time I saw her, she mentioned that her grandfather was dying. And I know him, and my son and I prayed the Divine Mercy Chaplet for him, and I've been praying for him. And then I texted her, and I said I would like to send a priest over to, you know, anoint him and give him last rites and the apostolic blessing and everything that he can. And so she wrote back and said, thank you, but the Baptist pastor is coming over. And I think that's the church she's going to now. And I wrote back and I said, Rhonda, keep in mind that your pastor is not, in capitals, an ordained priest who was given the power by Jesus to loose and bound. He was not given the right to conduct last rites, the sacrament. I can't let a soul die without heaven's gift if I can help. And she wrote back, oh, I can't express how much I appreciate your love, blah, blah, blah. But he's a steadfast Baptist, and I respect that religion. We have to move forward as the family we are. And I don't want to leave it there. I want him to die in the Catholic Church. A priest did that for me, for a neighbor whose mom was Baptist. He went over there. He just asked her the questions, do you accept Jesus? You know, the questions, baptized her. He was so happy, gave her Holy Communion, and she died in the Catholic Church. And I want that for Bob, but I don't know. I don't have his contact information, and I don't know how to make it happen.
Okay, thanks. Okay. So let me clarify a couple of things. So the man who's dying, his name is Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now I think you communicated that Bob is not a Catholic. Is that correct?
He's Baptist.
He's a Baptist,
to
right?
His
okay.
Granddaughter.
And has
yes.
has he expressed any interest in becoming a Catholic that you know of?
No.
Okay. So I'll tell you what I would do in your situation. You have done what I think a person could reasonably do to try to reach him with the sacraments of the Catholic faith, since neither he nor his proxy have shown any interest in the ministrations of a Catholic priest. I think you're going to have to leave it there. And you're going to pray for the repose of his soul and trust in the mercy of God. You know, the church says that we can't compel anyone to accept Catholic faith. We can make the invitation. Yeah. We can't compel them.
Right. And thank you so much for your call, and thank you for being such a good friend. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's called a communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to Russ now, listening in Nashville via our podcast. Russ, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, guys. My question is about in Ephesians, where it talks about the fivefold ministry, right? So evangelists, shepherds, was apostles, prophets, teachers. What's the Catholic understanding of that? I know in Protestantism, you know, there's a wide range of opinions.
Sure.
What do you guys
yeah, absolutely. So clearly, these are all functions. These are all functions that have to be exercised within the church. That doesn't follow that they are all established offices. You can have a function without an office. You can have an office without a function. And so, you know, in terms of the offices, apostle is an office in the Catholic Church. And the apostles had a foundational role in handing on the deposit of faith. And the apostles ordained successors, which are the bishops of the Catholic Church. And you'll notice that, say, for example, the pastoral epistles don't speak in these terms of these five particular functions. They do, however, talk in terms of offices, and they mention overseers and presbyters and deacons specifically, mm-hmm. right? So we have the apostolic office in the persons of the 12. We have their successors in the persons of the bishops. Prophecy was an office in the Old Testament, often attached to the royal court, but seems to have been a sort of charismatic gift in the new.
Okay.
And so it isn't necessary. It's not essential to the church's constitution that, say, every parish have an appointed prophet, right? Although prophecy as a gift can exist within Catholicism and has and continues to do so, and there are some celebrated characters in Catholic history that, in my judgment, were possessed of the supernatural gift of prophecy, not so much the ability to foretell the future as to speak the word of God with boldness in a way that brings supernatural conviction that transcends our ability to understand. One that I am fond of citing is a medieval female mystic named Catherine of Siena, who was a person of no account, really, but she had this incredible gift, and she could march out into the middle of a battlefield between warring princes and Italian city-states and say something like, "Stop in the name of Jesus Christ," and doggone it, they stopped.
Wow.
You know, I mean, she could stop armies, you know, with the power of her prophetic personality.
Yeah.
But she had no established office. She just had a gift, right, and holiness. Pastor in, oh, I should say evangelist, okay, so evangelism, again, is a function. It's a role that individuals within the Catholic Church operate. It could be an appointed position, but there is no established canonical position called evangelist where everybody has to have a kind of ordained evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
Pastor actually is an established office in the Catholic Church, and it's a juridical role, and it's attached to a particular Christian community. We call them parishes. And so every parish is meant to have its own pastor who is a teacher, who sanctifies through the celebration of the sacraments and comforts and so forth. But he also governs and rules and makes decisions about, you know, who gets to have the rec room on Thursday night. he calls the shots. And then, of course, teacher also can be a function or an office. It's the function of every bishop. Bishops, one of the bishop's primary jobs is, in fact, to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Pastors and priests are authorized to teach. They can delegate that job to lay people. And of course, education is one of the church's major ministry outreaches to the world. And of course, we have armies of Catholic teachers that do lots of good. And they should see their work as a vocation, as a service to the church, and as well as to the common good, and not just a career, you know. So all of these functions exist. Some of them exist as established offices. Some of them are more like charismatic enablings.
Well, there you go. Russ, thanks so much for your call from Nashville. Glad that you're watching us there on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Patrick is listening to us in San Antonio on the Great Guadalupe Radio. First-time caller. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, y'all. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just have a question or maybe an insight of the 4th century early church and, of course, the Council of Nicaea, and just a point of view you can help me with from a Protestant point of view. I'm Catholic, but from a Protestant point of view, and why a lot of Protestants don't agree with the 4th century, especially with coming with the sacraments such as infant baptism. I've heard a lot of claims from Protestants about the 4th century and how the early church kind of fell off from the true teachings of the apostles. I was wondering if you have any insight and elaborate more on that particular time frame.
I sure do. I really appreciate the question. So Protestantism as a whole is characterized, and look, when I say Protestantism as a whole, am I generalizing? Yes, I'm generalizing.
Have to.
William Blake said to generalize is to be an idiot. Okay, so you because if you generalize, you there's always some exception to the rule.
Of course.
Okay, so if you're that exception to the rule out there, I'm not talking about you, but the vast majority of Protestants.
Got it.
All right, have a theory about the origin of their own tradition, and the theory presupposes a doctrine of primitivism. That is to say, the idea that the early church, and they all define that differently. What does early church mean? Well, they draw the line in different places.
Mm-hmm.
For some, early church means the New Testament community. For some, it means the first 4 centuries. For some, maybe it's the first 2 centuries. For some, it's the first 1,000 years, right? But all of them have a different conception, but they all have this idea that the primitive church, whatever that means, somehow or another got it right, and that at some place along the line, the evil, bad Catholics got off on the wrong foot, and the Reformers, and again, who's a Reformer? Well, the founder of my denomination. The Reformers got us back on the right foot. Now, you almost have to have that ideology. You don't absolutely have to, but you almost have to have that ideology to be a Protestant for an obvious reason. Wherever you start the timeline of your own tradition, it ain't in antiquity. right? All these guys had historical founders in linear time located someplace in, you know, in the Gregorian calendar, and you know, most of them post 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Luther dates from the early 16th century. The Calvinists, of course, date, you know, a couple decades later.
Mm-hmm.
Anglican Church from the 1520s. You know, the Baptists date from, I think, 1609. John Smith founds a Baptist denomination, Baptist religion. The Methodists from the 18th century. Pentecostalism from the turn of the 20th century, 1900, 1901. And so you're confronted with an obvious problem. How could Christianity have existed for 2,000 years when people who get it right, namely us, have only been around for 100 years, 200 years, 400 years,
yeah.
500 years at the most?
Mm-hmm.
And the way almost all of them answer that question is to say, well, there is this utopian period in the past, and we have recovered it. Okay, now, here's the interesting thing about that theory. The theory has to come from somewhere. Like, it's not presented in Scripture. The Bible doesn't talk about a pristine early church from which the world will defect only to be recovered by future reformers. That's not the picture of history that the New Testament paints. It certainly doesn't paint the New Testament church itself as any kind of pristine wonderfulness. I mean, in fact, the New Testament church is obviously replete with controversy and heresy and schism and immorality and all kinds of nastiness, right? So it's not in any way depicted as ideal. Any more so is it something to fall away from and then recover. That idea has to emerge from someplace. Here's the fascinating thing. You know where that idea comes from? It doesn't actually start with Protestants. It's actually Catholics that invent the idea of reform. And it begins in the monasteries in the Middle Ages when they try to reform their living of the Benedictine rule and get back to a more ancient adherence to the Benedictine rule.
Mm-hmm.
Then it comes to penetrate the papacy because former monks entered into the papal office and they'd lived a reforming ideology as monks. They decided to bring it to the papacy and that to the whole church. And then, of course, it spreads through the populace. And so it's really in the 12th century that you begin to see this ideology of reformism begin to spread through the Catholic world. And there are whole religious orders that pop up in response to that vision. Some of the most famous would be the Franciscans and the Dominicans, both of whom are trying to reform Christendom by return to an ancient model. And in their case, it would be imitation of Christ and the apostles as presented in the Gospels. That's the rule of life that St. Francis took for himself, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Luther finally gets on the scene in the 16th century, he's just singing a very old song, a song that's 500 years old by now, or 400 years at least. Like he himself is a beneficiary of that Catholic reformist movement. He takes it in a different direction, but he inherits the idea of primitivism and reformism
mm-hmm.
from Catholic sources. I think that's important to recognize. Now, you know, as far as it comes to the 4th century specifically, you know, it's certainly not the case that all Protestants think the 4th century was where things got bad. Historical Protestants, like 16th century Protestants, the major confessional Protestants, they loved the 4th century. It was the 4th century they wanted to get back to. Luther and Calvin wanted to get back to the 4th century, not to the 3rd, not to the 2nd, not to the 1st. They wanted to go back to the Church of the Councils. They wanted to go back, so they claimed.
Yeah, yeah.
They wanted to go back to the Church of the Councils. They wanted to go back to the Church of the Holy Hierarchs. They wanted to go back to the Church of Augustine and Jerome. That's what they wanted to get back. They wanted to get back to the Church of Chrysostom. That's what they wanted to get back to. Jonathan Edwards, Puritanist, a Puritan preacher from the 18th century, he thought the 4th century was the bomb. He loved the 4th century. So Baptists obviously going to have a different tack because they don't like traditional Protestants. They think they're their own thing. But again, you know, they have a starting date of 1609.
That's true. Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. In a moment, Betsy in Dearborn, Michigan, will get to some of these YouTube questions. Hopefully your calls as well at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Why don't we talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's go to Betsy now. Betsy is in Dearborn, Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hey, Betsy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. How do you answer the question or the statement when somebody says they're spiritual, but they're not religious?
Yeah.
And also, an argument against Machiavelli or a book you can recommend that counters him, as well as something like Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now?
Okay, hang on. I'm writing all this down. I got a lot to speak about here.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, all right. So, spiritual, not religious. Let's start there. Okay. There's a 19th century American religious philosopher named Josiah Royce. From some points of view, Royce, I think, could be characterized as someone that was spiritual and not religious, right? Although he was pretty smart about it. And he wrote a book called Sources of Religious Insight. And I like it. It's one of my favorite books in philosophy of religion. And what his project is he says, look, there are all these different religions in the world, and they're all aiming at something. Rather than diving in and saying, you know, Christianity is true or false, or Judaism is true or false, or Hinduism is true or false, let me see what I can come up with as a philosopher to figure out, you know, is there some kind of common core of things they're all striving for? And what in philosophy could give me insight into what that is and how these different traditions may or may not go about meeting those needs? Now, you can quibble with his answers, and you can say he got it right or he got it wrong, but I don't think the project itself is without value. And this is what Royce says. It's one of my favorite quotes. I just love this quote, right? And I'll tell you why I like it in a second. So he could be wrong about this, but this has his analysis of the religions. He says, you know, what they're aiming at is rather the ideal of the triumph over our own unreason, right? Namely, that we have rationality, but we're kind of at war with our rationality. Like we, you know, how many times you say, I knew I shouldn't have done that. Well, then why the heck did you do it? It's the idea that the reign of caprice, you know, our whims and passions.
Yes.
The reign of caprice ought to be ended, that the wounds of our spirit ought to be healed. In the midst of all our caprices, or because of our caprices, we learn the value of one great spiritual ideal, and that's the ideal of spiritual unity and self-possession. Now, there may be other things you could say about the quest over the religious life, but I think as far as it goes, I think Royce is basically correct. Now, one of the reasons I like this quote is, isn't that exactly what St. Paul says in Romans chapter 7? Paul says, you know, I see this law at work in my mind that loves the law of God and desires to do good, but there's another law in my members, and it's at war with the law of my mind.
Yes.
What a wretched man I am. I'm at war with myself. You know, like, what's the solution to this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, throughout history, going way back, I mean, all the way back to the origins of the Western philosophical tradition, I mean, before Christianity, to be sure, back to Plato, back to Aristotle, back to the Stoics, philosophers and religious leaders and thinkers recognized that the solution to this problem, however you conceptualize it, is not easy to attain. That it takes discipline, it takes insight, it takes wisdom, it takes practices that can ameliorate my self-deception, my war with myself. This requires that I form new habits. There's a great historian of philosophy named Pierre Hadot. He has a book called what is it called? Spiritual Exercise. Philosophy is a Way of Life. That's the title. Philosophy is a Way of Life. Spiritual Exercises from Socrates to Foucault.
Okay.
Another one called What is Ancient Philosophy? And what Hadot draws out is that for much of ancient philosophy, philosophy was about ameliorating these wounds of the spirit that Royce identifies. It was about how to overcome our unreason. And specifying practices, prescriptions, if you will, to train the mind and the heart and the will to overcome these perennial problems. Now, philosophy lost sight of that, and it doesn't behave that way anymore, but religions still do. And not just Christianity, but many religions, they curate, some more or less successfully, ways of approach, practices. we might, you know, liturgies, devotions, doctrines, ethical codes, communities, and so forth. They curate these practices to as tools to accomplish the sin, to ameliorate these wounds of the Spirit, to help overcome our unreason, to help subjugate our passions, to help us live more humane lives, to be better versions of ourselves, to transcend ourselves, you know, to be a force for good in the world. And they're stores of wisdom and value, you know, because many of them are ancient and they reach back into antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had the crucible of human experience to work out, you know, good and bad responses to these problems, and they have you know, wisdom and insight to draw upon. And so, you know, as an argument for religion, not just for Christianity, I would say, if you are a person like St. Paul, if you're a person like Josiah Royce, if you're a person like Socrates, you know, if you're a person like Gautama Siddhartha, you're a person who like St. Augustine, Augustine Aurelius, Aurelius Augustine, who wakes up one day and says, I don't like the man that I am, and my life isn't going well, and I'm dissatisfied with my life, and I'm striving to get beyond. You know, I want to move beyond myself and beyond my limitations. I want to become a better version of myself and do more good in the world. Well, there's two ways you could approach that, I suppose. Let me reach out to the greatest sources of wisdom and insight that I can find to lay hold of spiritual practices and traditions and habits that have been proven through the test of time to ameliorate the human condition. Or I'm just a genius and I'll do it all on my own. Right? And you know, I could just sit down in front of YouTube and just like scan videos on personal improvement and I'll come up with my own self-help scheme. Right? Well, you know, that's pretty immature.
Yes.
Pretty narcissistic, fairly hubristic. But entering into the life of a community and a tradition, adopting its terms, its point of view, its perspective on reality, joining its community, availing myself of the resources and the support therein, as a set of tools and practices to ameliorate my underlying spiritual malaise, strikes me as good sense and wisdom, right? You know, yeah, so that's spiritual but not religious, in my judgment, is someone who recognizes that there is such a thing as a spiritual quest, but chooses not to affiliate with one of these wisdom traditions mm-hmm. that has been doing this for 2,000 years and says, well, I'll figure it out on my own. And of course, it speaks to the spirit of the age, which is individualistic and anti-authoritarian, anti-hierarchical, and distrustful of authority and expertise.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean that it's wise, right, to do so, right? Now, what would I say in response to Machiavelli? Well, you know, Machiavelli is, the term Machiavellian is, of course, drawn from his name, and a Machiavellian mm-hmm. individual is one who will literally do anything to get on top. Lie, cheat, make alliances, break alliances, manipulate in order to achieve whatever political or self-aggrandizing goals that he or she has for oneself. And you know, if you have a fairly truncated view of the human person and human happiness, and you think that your satisfaction in life can be you know, satisfied, eventually fulfilled, simply by the raw acquisition of power, well, then Machiavellianism is the way to go. But if you think the human person is more than that, then Machiavellianism is not the way to go. Now, here's what reason shows in answer to that challenge. Long time ago, Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, wrote the first major treatise in the Western tradition on ethics, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. And you know, we think of ethical questions today in terms of, you know, what's right or wrong. If you, you know, is it, you know, can you, you know, kill three ducks to save five and try to do these kind of moral calculuses in these weird hypothetical scenarios? That's not the way the Greeks thought about ethics. The Greeks thought about ethics this way. They said, what does it mean to live a good human life? And they had a really robust conception of what that meant like. How do I live well in community? You know, what's the ideal sort of polity that can contribute most to human flourishing? What should I do with my own mind? You know, what do I do with my thirst for wisdom and knowledge and understanding? How about my desire for relationship and authenticity and to know and be known by another human being? You know, the Christian era rolls around, we start asking questions about taking care of the marginalized and the poor and whether, you know, to whether and to what extent I should identify with them and their interests and how societies ought to be structured to take account of the poorest of the poor and whether we ought to make a place for them and are there human rights? And all these kinds of questions get drawn into the discussion about what human flourishing looks like and what is a fulfilling life after all. And then modern philosophy and research has, of course, been on this question. And there's a whole field today called positive psychology that's not just trying to fix pathology. It's asking, what does it take to have a not just a life that isn't sick, but a life that's good? Interestingly, one of the leaders in the field of positive psychology is a guy named Martin Seligman. Seligman is an atheist. He's also a relativist, meaning he doesn't believe there's any absolute right or wrong. Doesn't believe there's a God. He was a former head of the American Psychological Association, I think. And he summed up the state of the research to his day in a book called Authentic Happiness, which I recommend as a kind of complement to Aristotle's ethics.
Okay.
And Seligman, and Aristotle's not a relativist, but Seligman is. And this is what Seligman says. He says, you know what? I'm a relativist. I'm an atheist. I don't think there's any right or wrong. I don't think there's any good or bad. I think it's just, you know, whatever floats your boat. So if you want to go lop off your toes, have at it, bud. Enjoy yourself. You know, I'm not going to tell you it's wrong to do so. I can, however, tell you what the research shows. And what the research shows is that people who live like there's meaning, purpose, and value, people who associate with a wisdom tradition, people who undertake spiritual practices, people who try to transcend their raw, naked political quest for power, in other words, people who have virtues, people who have signature strengths, these people are on balance much happier, much more resilient. They just do better. They flourish in life more than the raw, naked ambition people do.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hey, if you're into raw, naked ambition, have at it, bud. I'm a relativist. If that's what you like, go for it. But you're not going to be as happy as the guy that can live the virtuous life. And that's coming from a modern atheist, you know, who's done the research and looked at the empirical data. And so, again, you know, to Machiavelli, I would say, you know, look, I probably can't convince you in the course of a conversation that life is worth living. Right?
Yeah.
But if you're one of the people who thinks it is, then there's a lot of arguments I can give you that Machiavellianism is not going to give you the kind of life that's worth living.
Betsy, is that helpful for you?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your call today. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. If you are a fan of the Rosary, we've got you covered. EWTN Radio brings you the Holy Rosary twice each day. That's every day. We've been doing it for over 30 years now. Tune in every morning at 5:30 Eastern for Mother Angelica leading the Rosary. Every evening at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for Father Benedict Groeschel. You'll hear it only on EWTN Radio. Excuse me. Quick question here from Matt. This is one of those that came in yesterday on YouTube that we couldn't get to, so we're going to have at it today. Matt says, can Dr. Anders suggest a rule of life for working guys with kids? How should we balance work, family, prayer, and an occasional round of golf?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question.
Isn't that great?
So, yeah, sure. So, I will... my thinking on this has evolved a lot over the decades.
Okay.
As a family guy, I'm 54, I've got 5 kids, 2 grandkids, you know, I've had different jobs and responsibilities, I've made friends, I've lost friends, I've lived through tragedy, I've come out the other side, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of experiences, and my thoughts on a good rule of life have changed. And in my younger days, I was... Catholics always emphasize the value of prayer, of course, and devotion and religious exercises. The way they're valuable in my life, I've come to view differently. Here's what I mean by that. I used to think that it was really important to kind of block out time from empirical reality in order to enter into a kind of unseen world of my interior life and sort of gaze inwardly on my own thoughts and emotions. You know, either to curate them and to sort of work on them and fix them or to find, you know, various kinds of inspiration and insight in there. In other words, I construed kind of the ends of my spiritual quest and activity as something that was set over against the rest of the details of my vocational life of parent and job and work. And and I thought, okay, maybe I go into that secret hidden place so I can come out and do a better job there. But still, they're kind of two different worlds. And what I've realized is that when I look around me at the people in life that I have admired most, you know, as fathers, as husbands, they had blessed little time for navel-gazing nonsense. You know, they really did.
Yeah.
You know, my grandfather was a person who was just had enormous amounts of integrity. I mean, just enormous. When he died, I mean, people came out of the woodworks talking about what an incredible guy he was. And I remember asking my uncle one time, I said, you know, Uncle, what did your father do in his spare time? And I'd heard my dad's stories, of course, but I wanted to hear my uncle's stories.
Okay.
Uncle looked at me and said, he didn't have any spare time.
Mm.
He spent all his time working to take care of his family. You know?
Yeah.
And my dad was kind of like that. He was a person of just unfailing, unflinching honesty and virtue. He would never intentionally do the wrong thing. He went out of his way to help people, sometimes in unsung and unnoticed ways. He was unfailingly honest. He would deliberately take the short end of the stick when he could have taken the long end of the stick, just because it was there. You know, I mean, this is a trivial example. But I remember one time I went out to eat with my dad, with my family, and we went to this restaurant, and we had the most atrocious service I've ever had in any restaurant. And not only was the service atrocious, but the waitress kept telling us how good it was, and dropped, like, you know, I don't know, 50 times or something, how, you know, I don't remember what her expectation for a tip was. I don't know, say it was 20% or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she brought the wrong thing here. She brought the wrong thing there. It was just nasty. And when she finally brought the bill, she's like, should I write in the 20% tip? And I was like, I can't believe the gall of this woman.
That's pretty amazing.
I mean, she literally asked if she could write in the tip herself.
Wow.
And I was like, you know, it's 15% tops. You know, if I'm feeling tremendously generous, like, it's not going to be this 20, and no way you're going to write in your own tip. My dad goes, yeah, that'd be fine.
Wow.
And she goes away, and I was like, what on earth are you thinking? This woman practically poisoned us, you know, and you're letting her write in her own tip. And he's like, well, it was really important to her.
Wow.
You know? And that was just a tiny little example. Like, you just multiply that over the course of a lifetime, right? And I've come to think, like, that it's not, I'm not saying you don't have a rule of life and you don't have time built in for spiritual practices, but it was like the spirituality was in the living. It was in the act of the living. It was the single-minded commitment to make one's family life the thing that one was about, you know? And one's commitment to one's principles, which just pervaded everything in one's personality, and that would include the golf game that you take time for. Like, you know, you're not gonna drop an extra ball when nobody's looking on the green. You know, you're gonna be honest. You're gonna keep to your stuff.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And then I really think now, I think that, you know, spirituality is much more about that, living that fidelity to one's vocation and one's state of life. And if your state of life is such that, you know, that golf games and a movie with your kids and stuff like that is part of your rule of life, then that's part of your rule of life too, right? And, you know, for me personally, the intellectual life is a very important part of the development of my personality and just very, very meaningful to me. But I also try to integrate it with my parenthood and my relationships. And, you know, you give your kids what you can. And I've been privileged to be able to, you know, say, talk to my kids about books and ideas and culture because that's my education. But I'm terrible at things like changing oil or pitching a baseball, you know. And one of my older kids called me a couple of weeks ago and he said, you know, I want to thank you for the fact that you raised us the way you did and you taught us the things that you taught us, and they were valuable to me. And we laughed about the fact that neither one of us was any good at changing the oil. But, you know, by golly, we could talk about ideas. You give your kids what you can give them, and you love the things that you love, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing, and it's not wrong. And then you make those crafts and those activities and those talents the workshop in which you teach the lived practice of the virtues.
Matt, thanks so much for checking us out on YouTube. I know that came in yesterday, but I'm glad that we were able to answer it today. Here is Frank now in Westminster, Colorado, listening on YouTube this afternoon. Hey there, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've got a question, like everyone does that calls in. If I am suffering, like, say, I'm going through a migraine headache, mm-hmm. and I offer my suffering to God as a means of intercession for the souls in purgatory or the homeless or whatever, but then after I make that offering, I take a couple aspirin to ameliorate my pain. Does that invalidate my offering?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So when I think about the Gospels, I think I can't come up with a single instance in which a person that was in physical pain and suffering approached Christ for healing, to whom he said, "No, I got a better idea. Why don't you offer it up?" I can't think of one instance. I can't think of one instance where Christ advocated that we seek pain for pain's sake. Now, he did say that we have to accept the lot, you know, that providence sends to us.
Right, right.
Right, that we, but Christ himself prayed, "Let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done."
Yeah.
You know, I was reading Epictetus this morning, the Stoic philosopher, and he wrote this prayer to Jupiter. And in his mind, Jupiter was like the top god. So it's like, you know, it's not God, but he's getting there, right?
Yeah.
And it was something like this. It was like, "Jupiter, give me the constancy to accept the fate that you send me, because it's coming whether I accept it or not." You know, and that's the idea,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, that God's providence is going to come down the pike and hit you square in the teeth whether you want it to or not.
Mm-hmm.
We have one or two attitudes that we can take towards it. We can either accept it or we can rail and run around in circles and bang our heads and be frustrated, right? But we don't have to seek suffering for suffering's sake to make an act of offering where we offer our lives with Christ. So in the morning offering that they teach us to pray, you know, "Jesus, through the Immaculate Heart of Mary, I offer you my prayers, works, joys, and sufferings of this day, together with the desires of your Sacred Heart, with the Holy Sacrifice Mass offered throughout the world," right? That I make a resolution that whatever comes down my pike, I'm gonna accept it, you know, as God's providence in my life.
Right.
It doesn't mean that in the midst of all that, I can't try to make prudent choices about how to better my circumstances and that of my family and you know, meet my needs. And I don't know about you, but when I get a migraine, which is not very often, but every once in a while, I mean, it knocks you out and makes it pretty hard to do other things in your vocation. I mean, most, you know, your parent gets a migraine and, you know, that's when the kids get put in front of the TV.
Yep.
Right. You don't want to put your kids in front of the TV. That's not how you want them to be raised. But sometimes if you have a migraine and you're throwing your guts up, you don't have any choice, right? You do the best you can. You don't want to stay in that situation. You can't live your life that way. And it's perfectly fine to try to get out of it. And that's not trying to thwart the will of God.
Very good. Frank, thanks so much for your question. We have just enough time for this one from Jack on YouTube. Can you explain Isaiah 53:5, where it says, quote, "Upon him was the punishment that made us whole"? I don't believe Jesus was punished on the cross, but this verse makes it confusing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, thanks. So if you read the whole thing in context, Isaiah says, we regarded Jesus. We regarded him as cut off by God and afflicted.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't say he was cut off by God and afflicted. It says his contemporaries thought he was,
okay.
Which is absolutely historically true. Like, the crowds looking at Jesus were like, "Oh, well, we thought he was the Messiah. Guess he's not. Messiahs don't get crucified." They regarded him as cut off and afflicted by God. Now, was Jesus punished? Not by God, but by the Romans.
Yes.
So it is an empirical, historical fact that Jesus was, in fact, punished. But he was punished by the Romans. The mistake his contemporaries made was to assume that God was punishing him. They were wrong. They assumed that they were wrong. Nonetheless, it was a punishment. It was a judicial penalty executed against him by which we are healed, but just not one inflicted by God.
Okay. Jack, I'm so glad we could answer your question on today's program. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Got to work on this throat today. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday, notwithstanding a throat issue. Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN. You can check out the podcast anytime you wish by going to EWTN.com, click on radio, and then look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thank you for watching and listening today. Hope to see you again tomorrow on the Thursday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, have a beautiful day and God bless.